Well, welcome to July's edition of IPIN's Property Industry Insights. This is your host, Eric Jafari, and I'm here with three property giants. I've got with me Merzak Kadur, who's the head of hospitality and leisure for Clydesdale Bank, as well as Ed Horn-Smith from Arcaco Structured Finance, who's the director. And I've also got, once again, Andrew Fowler, from who's a managing director over at Union Hanover Securities. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. In today's edition, we're going to be focusing on the wealth gap, how the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poor, and what it means to property and what it means to some of our listeners. There's a lot of talk both in the UK, across Europe and the US about how this wealth gap has been impacting the average consumer. I mean, the first question is it real? What are the statistics behind it? I mean, from a macro level, maybe Merzak, you could shed some light on what's going on in the UK.
Well, it's certainly real. Nothing has been done about it, to my mind, in the past 13 years or so. If we look at the stats, the top 1% earners in the UK, for instance, pocket 10% for every pound of income paid. You contrast that with the poorest half of the population, which take home only about 18 pence. That's quite a contrast there. This is according to a Resolution Foundation research, by the way. It reveals a widening gap between those at the very top and those at the very bottom. So the question is, what's happening in the middle? Inequality actually has not been tackled properly, as I said, in the past 13 to 15 years, and it remains a particular political agenda for this current government, and I would imagine future governments as well.
Ed, I know that you had some thoughts on what was going on within the U.S. Maybe you could shed some light on how this wealth gap has transpired in the United States.
Yeah, thanks, Merzak. I suppose just to kind of follow on from what's happened in the UK. If we have a look at the US, I mean, it's pretty stark, really. I mean, in the last year, for example, 99% of Americans' incomes increased by a mere 0.2%. Whilst at the same time, the incomes of the top 1% jumped by 11.6%. It's really kind of become more and more, exaggerated in that way. I mean, if we look historically, in the past, you know, in the 1970s, the top 1% of earners captured about 10% of the national income. 35 years later, their share's risen to nearly a third of the national income.
So what you're saying is the top 1% of earners, whereas they used to take home 10% of the national income, now they're taking home about a third of it. I mean, that's a big increase.
Incredible stats. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like, from what you've shared with me, it sounds like it's even starker in the US than it is in the UK.
It seems like it, yes.
I noticed, Andrew, you had some comments regarding between 1940s and 1970s in the US and what the wealth gap was then at that point in time. I recall you mentioning that between the 1940s and 1970s, the gap between the 1% and everyone else actually shrank.
Yeah, I think it's one of the only times in recent history, if you could call it recent history, that we've actually seen that gap drop. It fell from nearly 16% in 1940 to under 7% in 1970. And since then, we've seen it gradually rise back up again. So it shows that it can happen, but in recent history, it certainly hasn't happened. And there's certainly a fixed trend that's going in the direction that my two compatriots were saying.
When it comes to wealth gap, man, there's a lot of fingers being pointed at U.S. CEOs. I mean, whereas U.S. CEO, what was the difference between back then and, let's say, today with respect to what CEOs actually made?
Well, the average U.S. CEO made 42 times as much as the average worker. By 2012, the ratio has skyrocketed to, I think, it's nearly 400 times. So it's a clear divide that's certainly evident and certainly growing.
And families in the top 0.1%?
Well, I suppose families in the top, I think it's 0.1%, made about $24 million, and that's dropped sharply to about $2.8 million for those in the top 1%. from the top 0.1% to 0.01%. Those in the top 1% made about £1 million or $1 million on average, and those in the top 10% made approximately $250,000. Meanwhile, the bottom 90% makes an average of $30,000. So it's quite staggering steps as you go up the way. If you consider, as I said, 90% only earning $30,000.
All right. So if we take kind of a step back and look at some of these statistics, the real question that most of our listeners are going to have is how does this impact property? I guess the first question is if I were to look at these, the assumption I would take from this is that if the wealthy are getting wealthier, then what that should probably mean is that in the residential market, property values and the sale of high end properties have probably remained resilient since the Lehman crash. I know, Ed, you spend a lot of your time within the residential sector. Maybe you can provide us with some insight.
Sure. I mean, yeah, these stats really mirror what we've seen in the markets. Even post Lehman's, the more affluent areas have stayed buoyant. And when I say more affluent areas, I mean super prime. I mean, super prime has continued to grow from a number of reasons. But it's always been buoyant throughout.
When you make reference to super prime, what exactly does that mean? What's the difference between prime and super prime?
I mean, if you look at London specifically, the price points of £2,000 a square foot upwards have just stayed buoyant throughout really the tougher economic times.
Okay, and talk to me about hotels. I mean, how does this relate to the hotel market? More specifically, what can be gleaned from this if it impacts when you look at hotel investment? Perhaps Marizak, you could provide us with some.
Well, it's interesting actually because the type of investor that would be interested in a hotel asset class would typically be the affluent, sophisticated kind of investor. It's a specialist asset class, hotels. Different dynamics to that of the residential market, but it's interesting talking about the 1% either in the US or here. These are the kind of profiles that we are seeing purchasing either good opportunity acquisitions or acquisitions from the distressed portfolios that some of the banks are sitting on at the moment. And it's interesting that most of the money that poured into the hotel sector initially came into London. Mm. After a certain time, there weren't any opportunities really to be had in London. If you happen to be the owner of a decent asset in London, why would you be selling now? Now is not a time to be selling if you've got a good asset.
Why is that? Why would you sell?
Well, you look at the performance of London, for example, over the past four years, well, certainly since Lehman's. I mean, the performance has been astronomical. Last year, for instance, has been extraordinary in terms of the performance. People put it down to the Olympics, and they put the fact that there's been new stock added to London as the reason why London performed very well. I don't think you build a hotel specifically for one event. Mm. I think you build a hotel for 10, 15, 20 years. London performs because it's a unique destination. It's the perfect mix of leisure, business, and transient. And it performs all the time. And you look at the stock that we have seen last year, by different measures, is either between 6,000 to 8,000 bedrooms. There's more due to come in this year. We are still underbedded as a city.
Well, let me. I mean, on that note, why is it that London has rebounded so fast, whilst much of the regional UK has not? And does this relate to this whole wealth gap?
I think it does. Anyone that's associated with the hotel industry will be familiar with the two-tier divide, London and the regions. But that's not necessarily the true picture. You've got London, you've got the regions, and within that, you've got the rest of the regions. If we take London, we all know that London has performed very well for the reasons that we outlined earlier. The regions suffered specifically for three key reasons. One, the fact that the austerity measures kicked in, and the regions happen to be a public service destination. So the government, for example, is a huge user of hotels in the regions. I'll give you an example. Newcastle, for instance, the hotel sector almost deteriorated post-Lehman. One of the biggest users of the hotel stock in Newcastle happened to be the government, Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. Well, guess what? They cut down in the conferencing and the events held at the hotels, which brings me to the second point. So the first point were the austerity measures. The second point the disappearance overnight of the conference and events market. And the third point, which really almost put the nail in the coffin of the regional market, was the lack of investment in the stock. I mean, Lehman was a wake-up call, but before Lehman, a lot of hoteliers have to really hold their hands up and say they didn't invest in those assets. And we all know, Eric, that an asset that's underinvested will underperform a brand new shining hotel.
So when you say an asset that's underinvested will underperform, what, in layman's terms, what you're referring to is if I own a hotel and I don't spend enough money to upkeep the hotel
right.
and renovate it and maintain it, then right. the performance will go down because the user experience will diminish.
Spot on. And you know, Eric, within hotels, it's quite specific lines that are built in within the cash flows, in the profit and loss account that will mitigate against something that happening. It's called the FF&E reserve line. And pick a number, it's normally 5% to 8% of the room's revenue need to be kept aside for replenishing the stock and changing the carpets and the bedding, etc. If you have not spent that money on the asset, you will always underperform a brand new asset, a brand new hotel that comes not far from you. Mm. And that's what happened in the Regents.
Well, I think as well, sorry, just to sort of interject on that, I think it's quite clear that the UK hotel market is definitely two-tiered, London and the outside. But I think you need to be careful in comparing it to the wealth gap, because part of the reason why London has continued to perform so well is the emergence of global economies, and not so much the emergence of, you know, the top 1% of the world, but just emerging economies such as Asia, India, where people have the affordability now to travel and they want to see locations such as London. So it's actually the people in the lower tranches or the middle tranches of the income band that have actually been fueling the London market as well. So you just need to be careful when you're comparing the wealth gap and the extremities of the wealth gap with the two-tiered market that exists in the UK at the moment.
I sort of agree with that point. I agree with you totally, because also the regions come into various guises as well. There are regional locations where the hotel market has been very buoyant, has been very, very well run. And these are areas where the barriers to entry are very high. So you pick Cheltenham, Bath and Brighton, etc. They've performed throughout the last 4 or 5 years very, very well. But going back to the wealth gap situation, I actually agree with you. Not only London is a destination that appeals to new markets, but remember what we had in the last 5 years. It's been a currency play as well. The sterling has suffered, which attracted a lot of European demand.
It was a three-year low on Wednesday this week. Yeah, I mean, incredible, yeah.
How does that impact the residential properties?
I mean, Eric, just to kind of touch on what we've been discussing about the wealth gap and the divide between London, as an affluent economy, and the rest of Britain. I mean, I read a very interesting stat yesterday, and when you look at values and property values and prices, the 10 top boroughs of London, the cumulative price or value of the properties equate to more than all the properties in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. I mean, it's quite incredible, really. I think that really kind of illustrates where London is at the moment on the real estate side.
With that, I mean, that reflects globally, though, would you not agree, in terms of, you know, if you look at Paris, New York, any of these global, it seems to be a trend that's quite transparent across a lot of them.
Yeah.
Quick question. I mean, on this basis, with respect to, and I'm assuming it applies to residential as well, but moving back to just hotels for 1 second, if the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, one would assume that hotel concepts that are targeting the ultra-affluent, the likes of a Ritz-Carlton or a Dorchester, would have performed well over the course of the last 5 years and continue to perform well. And the budget concepts have done well. Is that true? And do we see that trend continuing? And are there exceptions to that rule?
Look, as an overarching comment, yes, because the upscale hotels, they appeal to a certain type of customer that did not suffer the pinch in the last 5 years. As an overriding comment, I'd say yes. The budget sector has done very, very well, but therein as well are different stories. Some concepts performed very well, others didn't. And we've seen a fight between two particular limited service hotels in this country, for example, a fight to stick a flag everywhere, anywhere and everywhere. Despite some locations, you would argue that maybe a particular brand would not have suited in there. But as a comment, yes, one sector has done very well, which is the limited service budget sector and the upscale. The trouble is the middle sector, which the retail environment refers to as the squeezed middle, that remains to be squeezed. And they need to do something with the stock that's in there, either demolish it or do something with it, because that's not going to perform.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly reflective in London. Where you've got the, you know, the darling of the hotel industry has been the five-star hotels, and that's because the ultra-affluent can afford and continue to afford that. Having said that, the rest of the consumer population is targeting value, and this is why the mid-sector is obviously suffering, and we've had the competition of the budget hotel sectors, the flight of investors into the budget hotel sector, which has been going for a number of years now and has created a clear divide or a two-tiered market again in the hotel market, with the sort of what we traditionally called four-star. What is a four-star, obviously? But they have certainly floundered in that market because people want budget. And what we're also starting to see now is the rise of hostels again. Now, they're slightly different to the traditional hostels we knew, not grungy backpackers so much, but design-led hostels where people are actually prepared to share a room once they're in a quality surrounding or quality building in order to save money.
Yeah, it's interesting you guys make this point, because there's this concept of ultra-fluent and budget, and then there's the in-between, which, as you pointed out, has been squeezed out. But I've noticed that there's been an emergence of what I've called affordable luxury concepts.
Yeah.
Concepts such as Citizen M, Motel One, Hoax, you mentioned Hoax, Urban Villa. Now, what's interesting about these concepts is it that budget will continue to do well, or is it that people are going to budget in the absence of something perhaps that offers a bit more, but add perhaps a bit of a premium?
I think that they, in some ways, they are the new budget hotel sector. I mean, I think that the budget hotels have been doing extremely well, and people are starting to say, well, hold on, for that price, surely in this day and age, I can get something that's a little bit more design driven, that's got a bit of sexiness to it, as opposed to the traditional, you know, MDF worktops, etc.
MDF worktops?
Well, just sort of not
plywood.
Yeah, exactly. people are looking for quality for budget now. So it's acceptable in the days we live in now that people should be able to pay a budget level but get a quality product. And I think that these design-led concepts, you know, we talked about Citizen M, we talked about the new design-led hostels such as Hoax Hostels, Generator, etc., are providing a budget solution at a design-led presentation. And I think that the traditional budget hotels are going to have to sharpen the game, or they're going to suffer.
Yeah, we've seen this actually in the food industry within the US, that you've got the likes of McDonald's and Burger King and some of these price point driven concepts really gain most of their growth overseas. And the concepts that have actually been gaining greater market share is what I would call this affordable luxury food concept. So examples of such would be Chipotle, Panera Bread. These guys have really been gaining market share. And what's most fascinating about that concept is that because of the fact that they're premium budget, they're not getting squeezed on their margins. They're not having to compete on price point, and yet it's still affordable for the masses. And I believe that we're probably going to see more and more of that. And on that note, I do want to go back to residential for a second. We've gone back to, you know, the rich and the poor. What are the residential concepts that you're seeing in the market that are doing well, and which ones do you think are not doing well? What are the ultra affluent looking for? And then when you have the masses, is there a resi market to be played there for the balance of the Brits?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think the super affluent, if you like, a lot of which are international buyers. They're looking for prime locations. They're looking for security. I think I'd go on to this on another question, but, you know, they're looking for political refuge in some cases, safety, fairness and taxes. I think in terms of the property they're looking for, You know, they're looking for, and I'm really focusing on the London market here, Eric, but you know, they're looking for prime, AAA postcodes, you know,
Belgrade. Does the postcode matter? Does it matter? I mean, could you just build a massive home in a non-prime postcode, and would it have the same liquidity? Would it be able to sell as fast as something in the likes of a Knightsbridge or a St. John's Wood or Hampstead?
No, it's all about the postcode, I think. You know, I think nationals come here looking for or targeting specific areas. I mean, it's quite interesting to see if you go to Belgravia this time of year, or you go to or Knightsbridge this time of year. There's definitely a tendency for certain international buyers, and you see that in different areas. Same with Chelsea, same with South Kensington, and very much the same in parts of North London as well.
Now, are you making the claim that during the colder times of the years, those places just aren't as busy? Does that mean that these people are buying these larger homes basically more as a summer home?
Yeah, I think so. I think you know, Middle Eastern buyers certainly have a preference for spending their summers over here when their summers are so hot. And I think if you go there in winter, there's a lot of empty houses, and I think that's caused the migration, I suppose, of the residents that were there previously, perhaps moving a little further out, so perhaps to Chelsea, let's just say. And I think the residents of Chelsea perhaps have moved out a little bit further, maybe to Fulham or Wandsworth, and it's caused a kind of migration, I suppose, of
if that trend continues, that'll mean that London has nobody living on the inside everyone living on the outside during the colder parts of the year.
There is an argument at the moment that that is happening in certain areas, because wealthy Asian, Middle Eastern people are buying and land banking residential property in London and causing what they're calling, you know, joking as ghost towns, but there's certainly floors in luxury apartment blocks that have no residents on it, because it's literally considered a flight to safety financially, and it is having the knock-on effect that Ed described.
Mm. I'm curious. I mean, you know, recently MP Simon Hughes of Southwark has tried to pass legislation and is pushing for a restriction on the foreign ownership of London properties. What are your guys' views on that? I know this is kind of a dynamite question.
I think it's not so much. I think that is a dynamite statement to say that. But if I think you need to restrict, put restrictions on leaving property vacant, because that's what's actually having the effect, not who owns it.
That's right.
Interesting. You don't believe that perhaps having someone stay there could diminish, you know, harm the unit?
Well, no, I think it's more the fact if there's nobody living there, it becomes a security risk, and that has an adverse knock-on effect for everybody in the area.
Yeah, and kind of to follow on from that, you know, it's not just the property and the security risk, but also, you know, it's the local shops in the area, you know, it's the bars in the area. I think it has a knock-on effect on them. You know, they've gone from I suppose, communities in some way, to being holiday homes. And when you do that in bulk, it has a whole knock on to you know, that the whole environment of
So we have an understanding that what you've said, Ed, is that the ultra affluent are going into places like Belgravia, Knightsbridge, Mayfair, and turning these once vibrant areas into perhaps now more vibrant during the summer periods. And as such, some of the locals who live there on a full time basis have had to move further out. Where are these people moving to, and where do the masses who do live in London, where are they moving to, and what kind of developers? Have there been developers who've targeted the masses and said, okay, I'm going to create a product to accommodate the lower part of the wealth gap? Or is that kind of something that's off the radar at this moment in time? Is anyone observing anything?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I suppose what's happened, when I say migration, you know, we start to see some of those fringe areas becoming more affluent as a knock-on, as a consequence. You know, that's created opportunities for developers, even as far out as some of the commuter cities, I suppose. So an example might be Woking, where you're, you know, 20 minutes from, you know, the West End of London, and you can buy there for a fraction of the price. And I think we're seeing more families, you know, moving out of town or moving further out of the city centre. And that's kind of had the knock-on effect of increased prices throughout.
So if you go ahead,
I think Eric, that's actually quite true. And something that maybe has not been mentioned is the impact that it had on our key workers. You got to remember the impact on the teaching community, for example, the impact on the police, the impact on the nursing community. These people now have been priced out of London completely. And yet we're running the risk one day of having a policeman having to commute about an hour and a half because they can't afford to buy something here. Or schools struggling for the salary they offer to hire teachers for central London. You simply cannot make it work. And whilst we're on the subject, something that we probably have forgot to mention is the ludicrous London waiting allowance that has not been appraised for over 20 years. It doesn't even cover the cost of the trains.
So what is a London
Waiting Allowance was something that was set up many, many years ago by the GLA, and that looks
at the Greater London Authority.
Okay. And it talks about a worker working in London, what's the cost of working in London versus the cost of working outside of London. And it's estimated, have your pick, from £5,500 to £5,700 a year. Now, with the cost of rail travel, with the inflation in the cost of living, it doesn't even cover your travel arrangements. And this is the impact that this
was. So this like basically a stipend, or is
it's an additional salary that you get
okay.
On top of your salary. It's typically either amalgamated within your salary, or you get given a salary.
And this is paid for by the government.
No, it's paid for actually by your employer.
By employer, okay.
So employer, it's set by the GLA, but it hasn't been appraised for over 20 years, and you know it is set at a parameter well overdue review, and people can't afford at the moment if they are key workers on reasonably low salaries. They can't afford to live in London. They can't afford to buy.
So if you were an investor or a developer off the back of this and you were looking at residential properties in London, what you'd really be looking at if you wanted to piggyback off of this is either A, on one end of the spectrum, the super high-end properties. And it seems like from what I'm hearing that it's still a resilient, a robust market, and it's not oversupplied. And on the other end of the spectrum, you would deduct from this conversation that you would focus on areas that have strong transport links into London, that whereby you're able to purchase a piece of property and deliver a piece of land at a reasonable price. But it really comes down to the transport links.
Absolutely.
And what areas, I mean, are there any specific pockets that you guys think are up and coming that are still affordable but within close transport distance that haven't spiked yet? Would you guys have any, if you had to pick a crystal ball, what would be the five cities that you would pick?
I think first of all, you got to define what's affordable.
Yeah.
And then you can work out how far you actually need to go out in order to tick that box.
Okay, so I'm going to take the example of £500 a square foot and below. Where would you...
£500 a square foot and below, you're going out sort of zone 3, 4 and beyond, really.
And for those who don't live in in London, what is zone 3, 4? What kind of cities, locations?
I think you're looking at sort of, you know, on the south side, sort of Lewisham, Greenwich, Stockwell. As you go west, because you're getting into affluent residential areas, you have to go significantly further out.
Yeah.
I think if you want to be close to the city, you've got to look to the traditionally least developed areas of the city. That's typically the northeast, where the industrial areas are. Mm-hmm. And you're going to get closest to the city with the best value in those locations. Mm. If you're going west, you're going very far out.
Mm.
On £500 a square foot, though, you know, you'd still be safely within London, right?
You would be.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. You'll still be in London. I mean...
And £500 a square foot and below, you're probably talking about younger professionals. Is that...
On a certain combined salary package, whereby the multiple, when they go to the lender, will be appropriate enough for them to buy a property.
When we talk about affordability, I mean, I don't even think we're talking about, you know, the young... you know, fresh into the market professional, really. If you're talking about affordability of purchasing in London, you know, when you're talking about property prices, where an average property is £500,000, you know, I mean, you could be a doctor and that's not affordable.
Yeah. No, it's a very good point. It's a very good point. So on the note of key workers, where do they have to move?
It is a major issue. The government has been promising for a while now to do something about the key workers. I think it's a bit of a time bomb. In a similar fashion, we talked about the CapEx time bomb for the hotels. This is a huge issue because you are finding now teachers having to leave London and seek out work in the suburbs, because they may not get the London waiting allowance. They get the regional allowance, which is smaller, about £1,800, but their salary will enable them to lower the cost of living in that part of town rather than London. The government need to do something about this.
What about...
Or it's an opportunity for the private sector.
Well, okay.
I mean, I'm not a big on resi, but I mean, obviously with resi, you've got affordable allocation within these units. I mean, it's very large in London. 30% of the units could be social and affordable. I mean, is this not a strategy to provide these key workers with
trouble? Is it not enough? It's a good point.
It's not enough. That's
typically
a fascinating comment to say that 30% of every project you build allocated for government housing isn't enough.
It's not enough, because the reason for that percentage doesn't tell the full story. The fact that London has not had new stock added in resi stock for a long, long time. Development on the resi front has stalled. We all know that in similar fashion that development in hotels stalled, because post-Lehman, people got the jitters, and there's been very, very little by way of development. Things have got a lot better since. But it's not enough, so we are still short of stock. And the second thing is about the affordable conditionality, is that sometimes you could tweak that and build and maybe switch the Section 106, which is about the affordability, and maybe have something like traffic management.
For those that aren't British that are listening to this, can someone please explain what a Section 106 is, just to...
I'll explain this. Section 106, basically, for every planning application, if you were to do resi, slightly different from hotels, they insist on a certain number of units to be affordable units. And that's quite rightly so.
And when you say affordable, so you were saying, I'm a developer, I'm building 100 flats, 30 of those or 35 of those flats, I have to basically...
To allocate specifically for the... How shall we describe
it? The social and affordable sector.
Sell to a local authority.
Correct.
And I don't make money off of those, basically.
You cover your costs.
Okay.
But also under Section 106, you can be asked to, it could be upgrade the pavement,
correct,
build a playground.
Absolutely.
A bus stop, a host of things.
Sometimes they'll ask even to contribute to the arts or landscaping. It doesn't always have to be resilient.
It's a form of tax.
It's a form of sharing, trying to upgrade the location. You can't just go in there and build something without adding to the location.
I mean, I think the point here is, Eric, the government are looking to combat the issue, and they've done some fundamental things to try and improve matters. So, as we've discussed, increasing and clamping down really on Section 106 allocations, also increasing stamp duty. One of the sole reasons for that was specifically to raise funding for affordable housing. I think the issue we've got, and I think it is something the government are aware of, but it's the backlog. And I think that's kind of the fundamental behind it, I suppose.
And when you say backlog, what do you mean?
So this is an ongoing issue and has been for a long time, specifically in London, you know, a real issue. So it's kind of tackling that backlog. There's a huge backlog of people without properties, looking for places. And I think although the government are aware of it and they're doing what they can to work on it, it's a massive issue to take on.
I was just going to say, it sounds like the backlog is still backing up even further. I mean, if we take the rough statistics of what we've been speaking about today and we talk about, you know, the top 10% versus the 90%, you could argue that every housing scheme in London, which is an affluent area, relatively affluent area, needs to be 90% affordable in order for people to buy in London. Okay, that's a little bit extreme, but it's probably, an arguable point, should we say. So, I mean, is it a ticking time bomb? That's the question.
Interesting. All right. So I'm going to move on to one. I've got two questions, and then we'll wrap it up. But one question I've got is, the government's recently, there's a lot of talk about PRS, private rental scheme. And I think in the U.S. you have what's called multifamily, which is a developer builds a project and rents out 100% of the units. Here you don't have it as much. Do you believe that PRS and the investment into PRS is a means of addressing this key worker issue, and perhaps not even just key workers, just people who don't have enough to purchase their own home? And if so, why has it taken so long for the British property market to all of a sudden adopt the PRS strategy?
The quick answer to question one is, I think the private sector can play a role in plugging the gap. Why has it taken so long? Because you got to remember, property values have skyrocketed in the past 20 years. Before, it was, if you're a developer, the play was very simple. You buy a piece of land, you develop the units, you sell them. You don't want the aggravation of dealing with 100 tenants. You don't want the problem with vacancies. You don't want the problem with all sorts of things. So it was easy to sell, develop, and go. There were very few that were developers and landlords at the same time. Is it changing now? We were talking about the time bomb in the resi market. I think things in the future could be completely different to where they were done before. Clearly, some of the parameters that we operated within the past 15, 20 years, some of them were successful, others weren't. And it will be silly to repeat some of those mistakes. I think the private sector has a role to play. The challenge there is, will the government be brave enough to cap the rent? Mm. And if they do, for the key workers, will that appeal to the private sector? That's the question that needs to be asked.
Ed, any thoughts on the PRS market? Are you seeing any developers try to enter the market?
If I'm being quite honest, Eric, no, I'm not really. I mean, my typical client will be looking to, I suppose, as a traditional developer would, buy, build, sell. I know that end of the market, certainly when you're holding onto product, is a lot harder to finance. It's very hard to take a development scheme into a credit committee where your exit is a refinance, because I think, you know, from what we've gone through in the last kind of 4 or 5 years post Lehman's, the confidence and the ability to refinance, you know, even if it's feasible today, who knows what it will be like tomorrow. And now the only real exit which is feasible, I think, for a credit committee for a development lender is the sale.
All right, last question, and it's not on this list. So the question is the following: if money was no object and you had all the money in the world, and you knew in light of this wealth gap, where would you put your money in the UK property market and why? So there's no crystal ball. I won't hold you to it. Just more of a kind of finger in the air. Ed?
Straightforward mid-market residential development in growth areas of London.
So what would you, such as?
Multi-unit. So when I say multi-unit, I mean, you know, well under 100, so say 70 unit scheme in Kilburn or think of some other areas, perhaps.
And why?
The reason why is because I think for the same reason that we've spoken about before, the migration of central London has had a knock-on effect, and now some of the nice suburb areas have got real growth potential. And I think that market, it's, you know, you're not restricted to the top 0.01% in London. I think it appeals to the masses.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go along the similar lines.
Remember, it could be any asset class. It could be office buildings. It could be sheds. It could be anything. So what would you invest?
Well, I certainly think that, you know, there's the demand for residential, obviously, in London in those sort of mid-tier markets is definitely there. And those sort of zone 2, zone 3, and even some areas of zone 1 markets where we're seeing big redevelopment to Elephant and Castle, you know, people, which is on the border of zone 1 and traditionally is quite run down. But there's huge amounts of regeneration going in there. Areas such as Hackney, Bethnal Green, can you still pick up some stuff there? But the sort of the peripheral areas where people can commute into town on local transport, there's great pockets where other resi has grown out behind it to very expensive value. So I think those pockets is where the value is on the residential market. I think going looking at the hospitality market, I believe in the new budget sector, as we talked about, taking the budget sector, which has done very well, it's got a little bit tired and repetitive, and giving it a new edge. So we talk about the design-led hostels, we see the emergence of serviced apartments, extended stay product, where people can get value per head, but still get a quality product.
Hmm. Yeah, I actually agree with the comments there. I mean, two things. If I pick on Resi, for example, I totally agree with your comments. Something that we haven't mentioned that is a major project going at the moment that will encourage the spread of residential units, and that is Crossrail. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to remember the residential market tends to go where there is huge infrastructure project. And going back to what we said earlier, the government sort of were a bit hesitant to kickstart this major infrastructure project, so that would have led to the spread of the residential development. If I pick Thamesmead area, for example, there are a couple of stations that are being built in there. You can bet your money that there'll be developers going in there, buying land cheap, and hopefully the cost of building at the moment isn't as expensive as it used to be. Construction inflation is almost non-existent at the moment. You could make it affordable. You can make the concept of design affordable. There are new materials that will make it so. So on the resi front, I think there'll be a lot of developments. It's a good market, I'd say a good growth market for the next 5 or 6 years. In hotels and hospitality, exactly as you said, I think, you know, we in this country, if you look at the brand penetration, we're still below the 35% compared to the US, which is an 80% plus. So there is still room for one or two brands to come in.
When you say brand penetration?
As in international brands for hotels, that the stock in the UK is predominantly M-branded. It doesn't mean that all of them aren't performing. In fact, some of them perform better than some brands, I'd argue. But there is room for this, like you said, take a budget concept, make it cost-effective, but add a design edge to it. It's affordable luxury, or a feeling of affordable luxury. You know, like Citizen M, one of my favorite hotels, because they took a concept that's very, very simple, and it's appealing to both the corporate and the leisure market. It's quite an interesting concept, which I think the way the market is going at the moment, there's going to be quite a lot of activity in that sector, I think.
Well, guys, I think that's it for today. I appreciate you guys joining me. Hopefully you'll be joining us soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.